Welcome to Words Matter with Katie Barlow and Joe Lockhart.
Welcome to Words Matter. I'm Katie Barlow. Our goal is to promote objective reality. As a wise man once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, not their own facts. Words have power and words have consequences. All right, Joe, so we've had a lot going on with the impeachment trial in recent days. So let's try to break down and summarize the impeachment trial and all that's happened so far. Last week began with a bit of drama. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had originally wanted the 24 hours for each side to present their case to be done over 2 days for each side, so 12 hours per day. In addition, he didn't want the House record to be admitted into evidence in the Senate at that point. But shortly after the trial began and word started to leak that McConnell didn't have the votes, he changed the terms. So walk us through what happened and why it's important.
Well, the rules that get codified in the Senate resolution dictate how the trial works. In a criminal trial or even a civil trial, and Katie, you know this better than me, there's pretrial motions and, you know, the rules of the road get fixed and then both sides know what they're allowed to do and, more importantly, what they're not allowed to do. In this case, for McConnell, what he wanted to project was that his caucus was together. He wanted to balance what the moderates in his caucus needed with giving as little as he could to the Democrats and the House managers and making this as short and sweet as it could be for the president. And he misjudged that. And he misjudged it by balancing too much on the side of what the president wanted and not what his caucus wanted. And when the resolution circulated the night before the trial, which in and of itself is a ridiculous thing that no one knew what the rules were the night before, his caucus revolted up to 15 senators. So they're not just moderates, guys like Tom Cotton, who, you know, he probably carries a gun and would shoot you if you called him a moderate, said that it was too draconian. So McConnell had to go back to the drawing board. He made some changes, which were acceptable. But the meaning of it and the significance of it was he only can lose as little as 3 or 4 senators on the crucial issue of witnesses and documents. And while he was trying to project caucus unity, he did the exact opposite. He projected caucus disunity and weakness. So it set the trial out on the first day on a very sour note, I think, for the Senate Republicans and Mitch McConnell in particular, and for the president. Now, they may still stay strong as a caucus. It's not clear what will happen yet on the vote for witnesses and documents, but it certainly wasn't the start that the Senate Majority Leader was hoping for. McConnell's gambit that failed stands in stark contrast to what Tom Daschle and Trent Lott did in 1999. They were able to, working together and doing a lot of horse trading within both of their caucuses, to get a resolution, the rules of the road, that was passed 100-0. So they were able to go in and send the message to the American public that this was going to be a bipartisan and fair trial. The House managers gave up some. The White House gave up some. No one was very happy, but no one was revolting. McConnell set it up in a way where he failed on both fronts. He tried to jam it through as a partisan, no Democratic votes resolution that disadvantaged significantly the House managers. And he didn't have the votes at the end of the day. So it was a double failure and really a bad start.
So now, looking to what's happened since then, the House managers have taken all of their time within the rules that they've agreed to, and they have basically started to build their case piece by piece, as any good prosecutor does. But they've also used it to take apart the president's case in advance, to set the record straight before Trump's legal team gets to attack the story, the narrative that they've built. Again, as any good defense lawyer will, they will try to take piece by piece away. And one of those places is in the false charges against Joe Biden and his son Hunter. So talk about how the House managers have handled the subject of Joe Biden.
The role of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden in the impeachment trial is one of the most interesting aspects of the trial. And I have to say, I disagree with almost all of the commentators and most of my Democratic friends and colleagues on this. The commentators last week talked about how the Democrats made a mistake by focusing for more than 30 minutes on the Bidens. Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia gave a pretty effective presentation about their role in this. The Democrats have said Joe Biden has nothing to do with this. Hunter Biden has nothing to do with this. Why are we even talking about them? They're both wrong. Joe Biden and Hunter Biden are at the center of this. There is no conspiracy without Joe Biden or Hunter Biden. Now, that may sound like a surprise coming out of my mouth, but let me finish the thought. The president made Joe Biden and Hunter Biden at the center. The president, in talking to President Zelensky and leaning on him and extorting and bribing him to start an investigation or at least announce an investigation, made Joe Biden and Hunter Biden part of this. So it was imperative for the defense to debunk any thought that Joe Biden acted inappropriately or corruptly at any time when he was vice president. Because if the House managers had left that door open, the White House would have driven all the way through it, which is this was a corrupt scheme by Joe Biden to somehow protect or promote his son, which would legitimize the president's public statements that all he was interested in was fighting corruption. So this is a central part of this trial. I'm just a little surprised that both the Democrats and I think a lot of the commentators missed that point. I'll tell you who didn't miss that point. Adam Schiff and the House managers. That was a strategic decision to go and face that. And they have left the president's defense team with very little room to maneuver. They have made a strong case that Joe Biden acted in the national interest and not in his personal interest. And by contrast, the president did just the opposite. He acted in his personal interest, not the national interest. And that is an incredibly important part of this and central to, I think, convicting the president for this conspiracy. Whether the Senate will do it or not, the evidence, I think, leaves you no doubt. But I think people have looked at this too superficially. And I think, thank goodness, Schiff and team and all the lawyers working on this understood this, because I feared if they didn't do this, they would have given a lot of room to maneuver to the White House defense team.
You started talking about Adam Schiff, and I wanted to ask you, because he's gotten a good deal of praise from his presentation and his overall approach throughout the trial so far, particularly from the left, but also from the right, even from Senator Lindsey Graham, according to some audio and pictures. So talk about a little bit more about Adam Schiff and the overall, the House manager team and how they're tackling this, knowing we haven't seen the president's team flex entirely yet, so we don't have a full picture of their side of things. But talk about the House manager team.
Well, you know, I would say first that Chairman Schiff's decision to come on Words Matter was obviously significant in his ability to lead the charge. we'll come back to this, but that was satire, sarcasm, fun, joke. But we'll come back
yeah,
to this.
Yeah, oh, we will come back to that, Joe. We are going to come back to that.
Didn't have to be funny for me to think it's funny, but we'll come back to that. Adam Schiff has just done a masterful job of organizing this. And let me, so I don't forget to do this, I want to throw three names out that deserve as much or more of praise because they're not getting it like Adam Schiff is. But Dan Goldman, Barry Burke, and Norm Eisen, three of the smartest lawyers in America who gave up their holidays to get the House managers prepared. So I think Schiff has served a unique role. His opening statement of 2 hours and 20 minutes, I think, you know, I said on CNN, I was riveted by it. And when it was over and I looked at the time, I thought it was 30 minutes. I couldn't believe that he'd been talking for over 2 hours because I, you know, it was like you don't take a breath. And he's got that ability to capture your attention and hold on to it until he decides he's said enough. And his closings each night that managed to synthesize all of the information that the other managers have drawn out and tell us why it's important and why we should care. Those are invaluable, and I think particularly Thursday night was genius. You're just not going to ever see a lawyer giving a 10-minute or so speech that I think is that impactful about if we've lost what's right, and what's right doesn't matter, we've lost our way as a country. There's no grander way to look at the significance of this. So I think Schiff's done a great job, and Pelosi did a masterful job of picking House managers. They all have strengths. I mean, Hakeem Jeffries is now an undisputed star. Jason Crow, someone that I have to admit I'd never heard his name before until it was on the list, and I had to look him up, and I thought, oh, it made sense. You know, you want somebody who can talk about the impact on the battlefield of withholding aid. The whole team. There's no doubt that they are first rate and have made a strong case. And they've done that. And they've done it in a way that is sensitive to how you program a trial in the modern age. I know senators have complained about the repetition, but the repetition was done on purpose because people are dipping in and out of this from the public. And I think they wanted to hammer this home again and again and again to senators because their theory of the case is if you make them listen to it enough, you may eventually find their shame spot. And we're going to find out when we see some of the votes whether there is any shame left in the Republican Senate caucus.
I want to take you back to 1999 to contextualize the battle that's coming next, which is about witnesses. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, and your input has been helpful in how starkly we can contrast what happened in 1999 to now. But in the 1999 trial, there were three witnesses who appeared by videotape deposition. Where do you think the Senate is going to end up on witnesses? Do you have a prediction yet, or still too soon to call?
Well, you know, let me do 99 first, and then I'll get to the prediction. In 1999, and this is why it's very hard to compare them, every witness, I think there were 65 witnesses that appeared before the grand jury, Ken Starr's grand jury. And it's somewhat apocryphal to say that the window washer's wife, whose dog walker's cousin, testified because they may have heard something. It's only somewhat apocryphal. They were an amazing assortment of people that called in, including Secret Service agents, a White House valet who, you know, prepared food for the president and the first lady and the first family. So there was no stone unturned. And I think that's the important point.
I got to tell you, as a good lawyer, those are usually the witnesses that are the best stones to turn over.
Yeah, no. And again, there was nothing that was not uncovered. And if you look at it, as I can look at it now 20 years later, that was the right way to do it, and the justice was served. The story was told in a complete way. We all had different conclusions, but there were lots of pieces of evidence and facts for us to build our case on. That's not the case now. But the three witnesses who were called back turned out to be somewhat of a disaster for the Republicans. This time, all of these people have information that we don't know yet. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, the White House will continue to throw up roadblocks. Late last week's it was, well, if you call us, we're going to assert executive privilege, and that's going to tie everything up. And Lisa Murkowski talked about how now the House wants us to do what they wouldn't do, go to court. First off, the White House doesn't have to do any of this. They could just turn it all over if they believe they were innocent. They don't, and they won't. On the Lisa Murkowski criticism, it really is not fair if you take one step back. And, you know, this is not a criminal trial, but our rules of law are, and the customs and mores around them are imbued in even a Senate trial. And the House was an indictment. And when prosecutors go to indict, they want to put as much on the table as they need to get that indictment. They don't ever want to reveal everything they have. Some of it waits for trial. Some of it they don't have yet. In the Senate, it's the trial. That's when all of the information has come out because the burden of proof is so much higher. And each of these arguments that they make that changes day to day as the Democrats torpedo them ring less and less true. So having said all that, let's go to the prediction. I don't think the House managers have the votes among the Republicans based on what we know now. Now, every day something new comes out. On Friday of last week, as everyone was getting ready for the trial to start, an audio tape of the president yelling in a meeting with Lev Parnas and Fruman and some others that he wanted to take out Marie Yovanovitch. I don't know what comes this week. But given what we know, and if it remains static, I think the Republicans will just bite the bullet, take the political heat, and try to shut this thing down. I hope I'm wrong. Justice will not be served. They will be responsible going forward for all new information. When John Bolton's book is published, Democrats will be able to, in each of the Senate races, say candidate X or candidate Y or Senator X or Senator Y didn't want you to know this, and here's why, and that means they're part of the cover-up. The Republican Party will be the cover-up party. Not where I'd want to be in an election year, but having said all that, I think they think the potential damage of these witnesses and documents being released far outweighs the political risk of them having this albatross around their neck.
Last week, we talked to Nina Totenberg, and she actually described for us the 1999 trial in vivid detail and what it was like in the room at the time, saying that the senators were very somber and almost sad. Give us your compare and contrast to that time.
Yeah, night and day is the best description I can tell you. The circumstances were very different. President Clinton, for his part, gave every Democrat permission, not that they needed it, to say what they think and to speak their conscience. And boy, did they. Whether it was in the House, we heard words like reprehensible, outrageous, immoral, and it got worse in the Senate because senators take themselves more seriously. We're in a dramatically different situation now where President Trump continues to say it was a perfect call, that he did nothing wrong, and that this is a witch hunt and a hoax. And Republicans are faced with a pretty stark choice. There's no middle ground for them. They're either standing with the president or, in the case of a few Republicans, you know, Justin Amash, who's now a former Republican, and maybe Romney, maybe Collins, maybe some others will stand up and say, you know, enough. We, you know, we can't abide by this. And the witness and evidence vote is a proxy for guilty and innocent here, because there are, we, everyone knows there aren't 20 votes to remove the president. And I don't think there would be, even if we get the witnesses and documents, and it's 80% worse than we thought. I just don't think the Republicans are capable of turning on their president, and that's because they're not capable of acting not in their self-interest. And that brings me to why I thought Schiff's Thursday night close was so powerful. He made the argument that you can't trust this president to put America's interest ahead of his own personal interest. And on the top, the first time you hear that, and he repeated it four or five times, you think, God, he's right. I mean, this president can't be trusted. And he did put his personal, and he's been doing it from the beginning. And that's a strong and really important point. But the second and third and the fourth time he said it, you understood, I think, what he was really saying, which is everyone in this room, everyone in this chamber, every one of you Republican senators have a choice. You can be like the president, or you can be like the public servant that your constituents expect. So your choice, and you're going to be tested on witness and documents, is do you put your personal interests first, getting reelected, keeping the president from attacking you on Twitter, keeping your donors and corporate PACs happy, who, you know, love the president? Or you, do you do what you're supposed to do and what your oath tells you you should do? And I think it was an incredibly powerful speech that really got to the heart of this and has got to the core of what the Republican Party is going to be, and what it stands for. And this is perhaps the last chance that Republicans have to salvage the Republican Party as we've known it over the last 50 years. Trump has been remaking it in his own image, which is corrupt, selfish, self-interested, dishonest, homophobic, xenophobic, at times anti-Semitic, racist, all of these things. And if they can't stand up here, the party is fully remade in Trump's image, and that party can't survive. I was on having a conversation with a couple of very progressive Democrats who are my friends this morning, and I told them my prediction is that Republicans will circle the wagons about the president, and we will look back on this 25 years from now, and there'll be no Republican Party. We will have two parties. One will be a Democratic Party that looks a lot like what Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar currently stand for, and we'll have a Democrat left, Democrat socialist, Democrat progressive party that looks a lot like what Bernie Sanders stands for. And that will be the choice, because Republicans are rapidly, and demographic changes in the country, it's like an endangered species, and this may be the last step towards saving them from extinction.
Let's talk about the senators who are the center of all of this, and to your point, Joe, will potentially move the Republican Party one way or the other after all is said and done. So every day the trial begins with a sergeant at arms saying senators have to follow the rules on pain of imprisonment. And there's some reporting in the room that the senators aren't following these rules all that closely. Some are in and out. And I will say I am not in the room. I have not been in the room. But my sources in the room actually say that it is remarkable that they are all sitting there and paying attention and taking notes. Although what their motive is for that is unclear, considering at least one or two C-SPAN cameras pan over to them a couple of times during the trial. But talk a little bit about the senators here sitting, drinking their water and their milk and that dynamic.
Yeah, listen, I think there's been too much discussion about the comfort issues for the senators. This is their job. This isn't hard. A lot of them are lawyers and have been through long trials, and they understand how this works. And if they have attention issues, they should medicate them and not disappear from the floor for hours on end, which some of them have. And they should not sit there and try to make a mockery of it, reading a book like Marsha Blackburn was doing. But who cares at the end of the day? If they don't want to take it seriously, that's on them. And if you want to talk about discomfort, let's look at families on the border who've been separated from their children and children separated from their parents. That's discomfort. Being held in a cage is discomfort. Having your SNAP benefits taken from you, like 700,000 American people have done in the last month, and not knowing whether you can afford your next meal, that's discomfort. Being, you know, in northern Syria as a Kurd, having been abandoned by your American allies and facing slaughter, that's discomfort. Senators who are bored, I don't have any time for that. And I wish they'd just shut the hell up about all this stuff. And I wish the media would too. It just doesn't matter. As far as the significance of it, I think you find from a lot of Republicans that they think that it's a political asset for them to appear bored. And they take Americans for being very stupid, or as Peter Hamby, the journalist, calls voters now low-information voters, which means not very smart voters, or at least people who don't engage and will listen to anything. I think, but for anyone who cares about this and is paying attention, the idea that they're bored shows that they're not serious about their job first. And second, and more importantly, you're bored because you're hearing the same thing over and over again. Well, what would make it more interesting and exciting? New documents, new witnesses coming in with firsthand accounts. And that's what they at all costs want to avoid. So I don't think they've been very smart about this.
Joe, talking about a couple of senators in particular, we've heard a lot about Susan Collins and Cory Gardner and the senators who are, you know, in cycle. What does it mean for them, this appearance of looking bored or saying the right thing when the camera is turned or saying the right thing when they're outside the room? And why is it relevant?
Well, I mean, it's both of them have in common that they're in cycle, and it's clear they haven't made up their mind which way they're going to go. And let's look at their political dynamic for a second. It's a It's a very highly technical and sophisticated political jargon, but they're kind of screwed both ways. They stick with Trump, and they've lost any ability to win moderate independents or conservative Democrats. And for Collins, that's a particular concern because that's been her constituency over the last 18 years in Maine. It's a particular concern to Cory Gardner because Colorado has been moving. It's been moving from purple to blue for a while. It's going to eventually be blue if it's not already. So their choice is to stick with Trump and alienate a lot of the electorate and motivate the Democrats to turn out, or defy Trump and lose the base of their party. For both of them, at the end of the day, I think Cory Gardner will stick with Trump. I think Susan Collins will defy him, and they'll do it not because of their conscience. They'll do it because of what their pollster is telling them to do, and that's, you know, of course, part of the problem. You saw now a couple weeks ago Martha McSally making her decision by going off on a CNN reporter. And that was clear. She decided that I'm going to be all in with Trump and just roll the dice on that bet. And we'll see. I think Mark Kelly's going to beat her. I think he would beat her no matter what she did. But she's made her choice. And in politics, having a plan and sticking to it is always better than making it up as you go along. There's other senators who are in different categories. There's Lamar Alexander, who's interesting because he's retiring. One of the most respected senators in the Senate across the aisle. He can do whatever he wants. He's a conservative Republican, but by no means is a so hardened a party loyalist that he can look beyond the wrongdoing of this president. There's Mitt Romney, who has his own standing. Mitt Romney, I think, no matter what he does, will always get reelected in Utah. He's beloved there. And he's trying to position himself as a different kind of Republican and a leader of different kind of Republicans. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who is an independent. Remember, the Republican Party got her thrown off the ballot the first time she ran, and she ran as a write-in candidate. Now, her dad had the seat, Frank Murkowski, and her name recognition helped her get to the Senate. But she doesn't owe much to the institutional party out there. And remember, she has defied the president multiple times, including as recently as the Brett Kavanaugh vote. And then there's wild card names that sort of came out of nowhere last week. Rob Portman from Ohio, who's a very reliable conservative, but someone who I think even Democrats think has a conscience and, you know, just hasn't fallen for the full-throated Trump show. And he's one. And then there were even a few other names that were rock-hard conservatives who at least were putting out there that they were thinking about this. Again, at the end of the day, I don't think they're going to get there, but there's three or four different dynamics with these senators, which means the White House and McConnell can't attack them all one way. They have to look at them individually and see what they need to do to try to persuade them and influence them.
All right. And finally, last week, Joe, you were featured actually pretty prominently on some conservative media for what I think was an attempt at political satire. So explain what happened.
Well, how do I want to start this? Let me tell you about a conversation I overheard on the Senate floor.
Oh, boy.
As I hope people who listen to this podcast know by now, because I hawk it at every turn, I do a little thing since Sarah Sanders stopped doing briefings that I call the shadow briefing. And I do it in addition to therapy because I think it's really important that the questions that would be asked at a briefing, that if you've been press secretary, you know what they are. You develop a skill for knowing where reporters are going, what are the big issues, that those questions are put on the record someplace and get surfaced someplace. So I had the idea of just using Twitter to surface them every day. Now, they weren't real questions. They were questions that I made up. But the questions were pretty straight. What does the president think about the Mideast peace plan that will be discussed this week at the White House? The answers are satire. The construct for that is, well, here's how a press secretary would answer it with two different thoughts in their head. One, I don't like my boss, the president. And two, I'm going to tell you the absolute truth. It'll be unvarnished. and with a little bit of exaggeration in there just for comedic effect. And I don't pretend to be a comedian, and I'm not that funny, but satire is satire. So I've been doing this for six, seven, 8 months, you know, whatever it's been. And I've probably done 100, 150 of these things. And, you know, they're all out there on the internet. So sitting watching the hearing the other day, I tweeted the following, which is a conversation overheard on the Senate floor, two senators talking. And the gist of it was one Republican said to another, boy, I haven't heard any of this stuff. They didn't report any of it on Fox News. I sure as hell hope that the president's defense team has some exculpatory evidence. And you went on my merry way, watched the hearing, tweeting some other things. And I, you know, I noticed that my Twitter feed was all of a sudden overwhelmed with replies. And I went and looked at it. And I don't pay any attention to the crazy people on the right. But there were a number from people that I knew saying, name names. Who was it? And I realized people were taking this seriously. So I tweeted out, this was made up. You know, relax. But the point is the point. Republicans are hearing the truth for the first time. Well, it kept coming. So I tweeted a second time saying, this is what political satire is. And if you don't think it's funny, don't read it. But don't pretend that I was trying to tell you this was for real. Well, what happened next was symptomatic of how the Republicans and the right-wing media have approached all this. They latched onto this, and it became, in the right-wing press, a huge story for them that Clinton's former press secretary engaging in fake news, making things up, admitting he's made things up. And at first I thought it was curious, and then I was like, I'm just going to ignore this. And then I got angry, not so much at the criticism, but it was from where the criticism was coming from. So I decided just to take it on. And before getting into how I took it on, when I said symptomatic of the response, that's what they've done at every turn here. Anything to divert from the underlying issues, anything to divert from the evidence, anything to divert from the president's wrongdoing and pattern of wrongdoing from the very first day he was in the White House. So they will latch on. Remember, they latched on to Adam Schiff's opening statement in the first hearing, where he said, this is what I think the call really meant. Everyone in the world knew he was engaging in a parody of a presidential phone call. But for weeks, the Republicans talked about that like it was the Watergate break-in. And it was the worst political dirty trick that had ever been done. It was not a dirty trick. Everyone knew, but they are so desperate to avoid a real discussion that they'll latch on. Now, thankfully, this has come and gone. But let me tell you, as a point of personal privilege, why I was angry. The people who were attacking me, and I don't care that they were attacking me, these are the people who gave us the birther controversy, one of the most dishonest racist attacks on an American president in our history. That the president was born in Kenya and was radicalized in Indonesia. It was an incredibly cynical, dishonest, ugly attack on their president. And the Fox News and the Breitbarts and the Daily Callers and the InfoWars of the world pushed it unmercifully like it was the gospel truth, like it came from God's own mouth. And these are the people who gave us the Pizzagate scandal. And this has consequences. A guy with a semi-automatic weapon went in there and started shooting. And thank God, no one was hurt. And he will spend the rest of his life in jail. So the very worst, vicious, ugly liars that exist in this country are in the right-wing press. They work for Fox News. They're people like Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson. They're people like Benny Johnson, who was fired from a real journalist job for plagiarism. So has found a home in the right-wing press. There are people at the Daily Caller who the hell knows who they are, the Washington Examiner. These are purveyors of hate, dishonesty, and they make money from doing it every day. And to have these people question my veracity and my honesty was just a little much. So I had some fun with it and will continue to have some fun with it. They continue to set their hair on fire. And thankfully, by raising this, I got 40 times, you know, 40x the times of response I normally get on a random tweet. So a lot of people now, thanks to thanks to Sean Hannity and the people on The Five at Fox, that message got out, and it's an important message. The last thing I'll say on it is the White House defense strategy, the Republican strategy, is to attack the veracity of what anybody says about the president, whether it's true or not. And so if someone gets one piece wrong, or they attack me, or they attack Adam Schiff, it is almost the end of the world. It's apocalyptic. But they don't have a single damn word to say about 16,000 documented lies coming out of their dear leader. So the hypocrisy here is so rich that it's almost suffocating. You know, it is 100 times worse than having to watch Lindsey Graham twirl around in the wind with whatever position he's got one day. And it's a big part of what's wrong with our democracy. I think when we look back on this time, Fox News will be seen, and we've talked a lot about this over the last year, as the single most destructive, and I'll expand it to the whole right-wing media food chain, the single most destructive influence in our democracy. And anytime I get the chance to take them on or call them out, I'm going to do it because I think it's actually a service to the cause.
All right, Joe. One last question before we go, just to set things up as we go into another week where it appears there will be a debate and a battle over executive privilege, and we'll start to see a bit more from the president's team. But as has become a recurring pattern throughout the entire Trump presidency, the more that happens, the more things stay the same. So on a final note, why do you think that this trial so far has done nothing to change any of the opinions, particularly among Republican senators?
Well, I think it's a sign of the cancer that has metastasized within the Republican Party that I think Schiff was getting at in a very subtle but important way, which is it's become the party that puts themselves first. It puts their power first. It puts their personal standing first. And you sure can't trust Donald Trump, and that's obvious. All the presentations so far that you've seen from the House managers make that point clearly, that he'll throw you over or throw you under the bus if his personal interest diverges with yours or the national interest. And the reason Republicans aren't changing is because they've somehow morphed into Donald Trump Republicans. And there's 53 Republican senators, and it is a very sad thing that not three of them want to know the truth, that not three of them say, let's roll the dice here and see what really happened. Not three of them will say, I took an oath. I'm here for a reason. My constituents expect me to do this. There's not three who will do that. And there'll likely, I think, be 51 who will say, getting to the truth potentially hurts my personal interest, and that's more important than the national interest. And as I said before, that means the Republican Party has become the Trump Party, and it's a party of corruption. It's a party that lacks principle, and it's a party you can't trust.
All right, Joe. Well, we'll be right back here next week with all of the latest updates in the impeachment trial. But as always, thanks for your thoughts this week. Until then.
Thank you. And try to get some fresh air. You can't watch this every minute of the day.
Yeah, I feel like the entire city is doing that right now.
Thank you for listening to Words Matter. Please rate and review Words Matter on Apple Podcasts and other podcast providers.